Overexercising, creating another kind of depression. There is so much for us to learn about it. Depression, what is that mood? What is that feeling? What is that thing? Now we've talked about it enough. Let's talk about it a little more. It's always good to learn new stuff. Let's talk about suicide for a minute. You know, suicide is an unavoidable part of depression, and one which better than no other embodies all the prejudice, the misunderstandings, and the narrow-minded attitudes towards depression itself. How often does a person hear some pompous proclamations about how cowardice or cowardly it is to commit suicide? Or the patronizing and delusive belief that with the proper arguments, one can convince a depressed person that life is worth living if you just talk to them enough. I talk about suicide in the context of a clinical depression. Obviously, non-depressed people can also commit suicide. You know, think of a person who's like suddenly dispossessed, or a dispossessed rich person, a politician irreparably stained by a scandal. You know, not necessarily depressed, but sometimes there's a thing called narcissism. And when you live a narcissistic life, and which is living an image of yourself, you know, like most actors and most actresses and most politicians, they're going around and they're kind of, you know, saying, here's who I am. Here's a presentation of me. And that part is a beautiful, you know, that's the way they are. When you look at certain politicians, they're perfectly groomed and they look like politicians. The trouble with them is they are living a narcissistic life. You're not seeing a real person. You're seeing kind of a shell of a person who is behaving a certain way, who is doing certain things, who is laughing at the right moments, who is not taking offense, who is, you know. So this being is a politician. Now, you take a politician like that and you look at their shell. They have a perfect wife. They have perfect children. They have a dog for their children. You know what I mean? They have a nice house that they live in. They have a certain adequate amount. They drive a certain kind of car. It's never too ostentatious, but it's politicians. But then something happens, and they fall from grace. They get caught cheating or having an affair or doing favors with somebody, and that person falls down. What does that person do? What do? They, of course, they feel with their image stripped away, they feel like they don't want to live at all. And here's where suicide comes in. If you don't have the image of yourself is no longer successful, and you are wounded, and the image of yourself cracks right down to the bone, and all that's left is the emperor without his clothing. You know, if that happens to you, some people can't take it because they were protected their whole lives from being real. Their parents told them how wonderful they were. They told them how great they were. They told them how important it was and what they were doing, and they were important. Then you take away all their stuff. It falls apart by one little burst in the bubble, and they are nothing. Now, that's when a lot of people choose to end their lives. The result of that is called a narcissistic wound. A narcissistic wound, which is a wound to the image of yourself, is one of the leading causes of suicide. People say, I have nothing left. There is no me. Now, you may or may not go into depression. I've seen narcissistic wounds go into depression. I had a friend who had a relationship with somebody. And this woman that he was with, he was madly in love with, she went off and she kind of found her old boyfriend somewhere on a trip. She was a dancer. And she decided she would stay with him. And I remember this friend of mine who couldn't believe that this could happen, because all he knew was he was in love with her and she was going off on a dancing trip. And then she wrote him back a letter and said, I found my old love. I can't be with you anymore. He, who was a pretty skilled, good professional, he wound up falling apart. He wound up in Florida. He was wandering the beaches. He was He was serving drinks at bars. That's what he was doing. He became a bartender, and he just kind of walked around and had surfacey sex and did a lot of drugs. But he was like a lost child. And he was a good friend of mine. And what I did was I went out and actually found him. And I said, Richie, what you doing? You know, and he says, I just can't get myself in gear. Well, after a few visits, he was an old buddy. I brought him back up to the, and he recovered from it. But what he went through was called a narcissistic wound. And a narcissistic wound very often will make people just feel like quitting. Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here in WBAI. So this leads very often to suicide. Suicide is one way to deal with that pain. It's such a big pain, a narcissistic wound. It's such a huge pain at times. But the other way of suicide, the other people who commit suicide are people who are just plain depressed. Forget psychology and trying to understand the problem. From a psychological perspective, when a person is that depressed, they're kind of lost. Now, remember that a depression affects the part of the brain responsible, among other tasks, for planning. Depression kind of works on the part of your brain that does planning. During the critical stage of depression, the brain is in such a condition that a person can't even visualize a future without the despair and the suffering. Because the very chemistry of depression is to impair the ability to project a positive future. That's why they're so negative. They can't see a future. They can't see a path out. You could do all you want by reminding them and telling them, you know, remember last week you were tending your flowers? They can't see it, they can't feel it, because the part of the brain that is affected by depression gets quelled. And it gets quelled in such a way that they can't see. This is Armand DeMille with you, by the way, with The Positive Mind, talking to you about depression. Remember that the reason becomes, it doesn't matter. Once it happens, it becomes physiological. Depression is a physiological phenomenon. This is hard to believe, but it is chemical. Not chemistry causes depression, although chemistry can. But once a person is depressed, they are a chemical mess. They are just working on all the wrong hormones, the wrong neurotransmitters. Things have gone wrong. Bear in mind also that the critical stage of depression, people examine experience anxiety crisis of such magnitude that they can't handle it. When you're depressed and you feel anxiety at the same time, you do anything to get rid of, to distract yourself. And this is the people who do self-mutilation. They hurt themselves. They actually physically hurt themselves because they have this combination of anxiety along with the depression. Depression should at least be graceful enough to let you feel nothing. But when it's not, and you feel anxiety and depression, it's torment. Again, don't think that you can imagine what it feels like. It is most likely that if you're not depressed, you can't imagine it. You have to have gone through it yourself. And even when you do, you don't know what that real depression is like. Just because you got sad, just because you got lonely, or you had moments of it, or grief, it's not real depression. Suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. There's a lot of wisdom in that sentence. And it's probably the best advice you can give a depressed person. If you're going to say anything to them, say that. You know, your suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. Unfortunately, during the critical stage, it's difficult for anybody who's depressed to visualize the temporary nature of the problem. When you're in that depression, you can't imagine a way out. You don't have the circuitry to figure out a way to get out of the thing. But saying it may have a difference, because this idea of a permanent solution is not such a good thing. If you have a friend or a loved one going through the stage of a depression, do take it possibly, take the possibility seriously, and do what you can to prevent suicide from happening. In particular, make sure that they're being handled by a competent professional. Fortunately, especially if people are young, the stage of depression will not last very long, typically just a few days or weeks. But if you know somebody who is really deeply, deeply depressed and they have no friends or anybody they can go to, try to get them to a professional. To conclude, if you've never had depression, you should feel inclined to make grandiose pronouncements about suicide. Bear in mind that you have no clue whatsoever what you're talking about. Suicide is a big deal. When a person gets to that point, you can't imagine the level of despair and disconnection that a person feels. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. So let's talk about depression. What is depression? If I were asked to come up with an alternative wording for what we call depression, a friend of mine said, there's that word again. I would have to say it's a problem of chronic brain overload. That's an interesting concept, huh? The key to understanding the brain, just like all other organs of the body, is that it has a limited processing capacity. And you constantly exceed it, disease will ensue. So now we're going to start with this concept. Depression is brain overload. All organs of the body, if you exceed what they're meant to do, they will have disease. The liver, for example. Many people know that liver is broken up. It breaks up the alcohol. It's also known that even a healthy liver has a limited throughput measured by the amount of alcohol it can process by units of time. There's only a certain amount of alcohol that the liver can process. Still, a person constantly overfloods their liver with alcohol. As typically happens with alcoholics, the organ has little chance of recovering from the abuse, and over the course of years, cirrhosis is likely to develop, which is a way that the liver gives up trying, and that's disease. Similar examples could be given for the kidneys, the gallbladder, and many other organs in the body. Occasional excess, if you're young, is well tolerated as long as there's enough rest period for the organ to recover. The brain is no different. So what does the brain process? In short, what does the brain do? It processes information. Think about it. Your brain processes information. Our cognitive functions are realized by the neurons in the brain, which communicate with each other through these things called neurotransmitters. So now we have this brain with all of these axons and dendrites and neurotransmitters, nerves, and the brain is communicating with itself. It's stuff is going on there. You know, there's a lot of electrical charge in the brain. If you were to watch your brain and it would be lit up, you'd be amazed at how entertaining it could be. When you perform a task that requires concentration, this requires heavy processing by the neurons in some specific part of the brain. See, the entire brain's not involved in all things. There are parts of the brain that are involved in creativity. There are parts of the brain that are involved in work. There are parts of the brain that are involved in saving things, in hoarding. Part of the brain is active in sex and sexuality. These are different parts of your brain. When you perform a task that requires concentration, it requires heavy processing by the neurons in some specific part of the brain, forcing them to dispense their precious supply of neurotransmitters to get the job done. So get it, if you worry, you need neurotransmitters that are involved in that kind of thinking. You worry too much, you wear out the neurotransmitters. Serotonin is one of those neurotransmitters we need desperately. You think too much, you work too much, you exhaust your mind, you worry too much, drop in serotonin. It's, and what happens when the supply runs out? Well, evolution has provided us with a system that can compensate in case of an emergency. It's the stress system, but that's the problem. When your brain runs out of neurotransmitters to deal with a specific problem, your body sends in part of what is the reaction, the survival instinct, and the survival instinct is the stress system. And part of the stress system, get this, my friends, is depression. Depression is a stress reaction. It's a physical stress reaction. Your poor brain got tired. You thought too much. You worried too much. You tried to figure too much out. You obsessed too much. Your poor brain, right? Now you're depressed. You were in love. You focused all your love in one spot. You used up all your hormones. You used up all your neurotransmitters. You tried to communicate. You thought about the person. You talked about the person. You called the person. They called you. They talked to your girlfriends or boyfriends about it. Everybody was involved in this one love relationship. You were exhausting your poor little brain. It was fun because the brain was being shot with all kinds of real juicy neurotransmitters and hormones, and that was fun. And then, boom, suddenly it ends. And he doesn't call. He doesn't write. He doesn't, you know, send you an email. The text messaging stops. And you say, what happened? The brain is exhausted. The brain shuts down. The stress system comes in, and we have depression. That's why people who end relationships get so depressed, you know, because their brain is exhausted from loving. What does your brain get exhausted from? What do you do to your poor little noggin, right? Like so many people do. Negativity, agitation, worry, concern, you know, intellectualizing, all of that can exhaust a rather beautiful little organ you got sitting there on top of your head that is really trying to tell you we're here for you. We want to be going. We want to work at our optimum capacity. Please don't overexercise us. Because if you overexercise your brain, you're going to get a big muscle in your brain, and the muscle is going to be give you a headache. Images. The idea is to talk in images. Well, you know, I'm not going to elaborate as to what actually happening and in what part of the brain. Rather, I'll simply present you a model which abstracts from the physical details. The neuroscientists are likely to disprove what I call a simplification, especially concerning the other involved neurotransmitters, which I won't mention, but personally, I think that it is a valid model for the purpose of understanding the behavioral pattern. So what I want you to do is to just imagine that we have we're going to start off with a normal neuron communication. The progression of an individual's maximum normal capacity, which we call the MNC, maximum normal capacity, has to do, in effect, with how large is your supply of serotonin. How big is your supply? You got a big chunk of serotonin? Can you replenish serotonin? You know the difference between men and women? Well, there's some differences, but among them is the way serotonin works. In women, it is not as easy to replenish serotonin. In men, serotonin gets replenished fast. So men, because of their muscle mass, you think that's the reason? When women lose serotonin, they get tremendous drops that they feel from it. Notice that there are moments when the demand is higher because of extra work, so emotional stuff, intellectual stuff, these all have demands. The communication between the neurons calls on this serotonin. When your brain, given that depression, affects the part of the brain responsible for, among other things, memory, learning, tasks that require concentration, organization, if you work too hard and you work too long, you don't get a vacation, and especially you don't get sleep. You're going to exhaust those poor neurotransmitters, and your brain is going to get sloppy and broken, and you're going to get cirrhosis of the brain. You know, you're just going to get it, and that's depression. So do I have a simple solution? Why does a person fall into depression? Yes, I know why. We could find a cause. When did you get depressed? How did the depression happen? Well, it could be happen endogenously or exogenously. It could happen outside your body. It could happen inside your body. A set of circumstances could make you depressed. Set of circumstances like losing a job and feeling the stress of that. That could work. Losing a relationship. Or it could be inside you. You could have hormonal changes and hormonal shifts that make for these changes inside you. You must have serotonin released into the synapse. The synapse is where the nerves, the end of the nerves are, you know. It's where the nerves meet each other in order for communication to occur. And one can imagine that the neurons really want you to produce as much serotonin as possible. So there's where sleep plays a vital role in replenishing the supply of serotonin. It's also the reason why towards the end of a hard day's work, we feel tired and sleepy. In a sense, it's your brain saying to you, time to stop. Let's get some juice up here. We're running out. If you saw a dendrite, and I used to see dendrites, I used to look at them under microscopes. A dendrite is like five fingers at the end of your arm. You know, a dendrite are these little things that reach out from the axon, which is the main part of your nerve. The axon is the shaft, and the dendrites are the fingers at the end. These dendrites, these fingers at the end, they have a little protein right at the end, at the tip of each of these little things. And that little thing at the tip, where the fingernail would be if you're using your hand, secretes these neurotransmitters. And it can only do it at a certain pace. If you don't have this neurotransmitter working, then you just exhausted, and your nerves are sitting there with no bath for them to be in, which means they can't fire impulses, they can't trigger impulses, and you get shriveled up dendrites. And boy, you can't see a dentist about that. Hey, doc, I want to see about my shriveled up dendrites. Well, a lot of people have shriveled up dendrites because they've exhausted their serotonin. What can we do? I wish we could take serotonin pills. We have things that we take that supposedly replenish serotonin, enhance serotonin. There's things that you could do nutritionally that you could do to kind of increase it, but it's really a battle. So it's fundamental to realize that different activities will exhaust your supply of serotonin at different rates. High concentration activities, reading, writing, engaging in intense conversation are very demanding on the brain. Other activities, where learning a new task is involved or requiring planning and organization, that's okay. On the other hand, watching some silly things on television is a lot less demanding. Sitting in the park watching a flight of birds is not demanding at all. Making love? A little demanding. Holding your partner afterwards? Much less demanding. Drifting off into a beautiful sleep after having made love, holding your partner? A lot of serotonin replenishment. This is Armand Mill with you with The Positive Mind. Now, of course, we have to keep psychology in the picture. You might be wondering if any description of depression would be purely mechanical. But, you know, psychology is great, and I'm in the business of psychology, but it's overrated. It does not mean that it's irrelevant. Psychology is important when another variable is included. Your attitude towards the activity that you're doing plays a large role in the rates at which your serotonin is spent and replenished. It is your attitude towards it. If you have to wash a floor, and that's what you do for a living, your attitude towards it is what's going to exhaust you or not. If you could wash that floor and do it with some kind of free feeling, that's beautiful. If you have to be with your partner, and it's stressful to be with your partner, that will drop your serotonin. Your attitude is what makes the difference. So mostly it's not that all of these things will exhaust one person or another. It is that you will have to find a way to not get exhausted by making sure that your attitude is screwed on right. You could do the most stressful things in the world if you somehow can bring to it a commitment. A commitment of, here I am now, this is what I'm doing. I am working for a boss I don't particularly like. I am doing a job I don't find very rewarding, but I'm doing it, and I'm going to do it as best I can. That person will not lose the serotonin, as will the person who's sitting at work hating their job. Because an important factor in the so-called burnout that we hear about is people who hated what they were doing. That's how you get burned out. You resented it the whole time. You were getting depleted. Of course, it's like blood leaving your body. Of course you don't like it. When the serotonin is leaving you, you're feeling yourself falling down further and further and further. So critical to my goal of demystifying depression is for you to be able to visualize the problem. And I want you to just understand that we're talking about a lot of things that affect it. And I, as I believe, as I've said to you, I believe that the psychology is very important. Discussing with a therapist, and why discussing with a therapist helps, is so that you could straighten out your mind about it. You have too much stress when you're all alone and you're dealing with something and you're just so totally alone. When you talk to somebody about it, actually, the very act of talking to somebody gives you less stress. It actually increases serotonin. That's why people go to nail salons. That's why people like to talk. That's why you get on the phone and you can talk for 20 minutes and you feel great after talking for 20 minutes, especially if you're a woman who has been very busy and lost a lot of serotonin. You get on the phone and you'll talk to your, I had a great conversation with my sister. I had a great conversation with my cousins on the phone, long conversations. A lot of men can't understand why those take place, but those are replenishing serotonin. Something in the communication does it. But if that conversation is going to be stressful, it absolutely won't work at all. It won't replenish serotonin. It'll increase it. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're going to continue with this. I'm going to talk to you with more facts about depression, more interesting stuff about depression, stuff that you may not have considered before. When we get back, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll continue. And then we're going to talk about the other hormones like cortisol, adrenaline, and other things that may be related to depression. We'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes.
I haven't slept a wink. I'm so tired. My mind is on the blink. I wonder, should I get up and fix myself a drink? No, no, no. So tired, I don't know what to do. I'm so tired, my mind is set.
Trouble in mind, I'm blue, but I won't be blue always, for the sun will shine.
I'm going to Illinois just as fast as I can. You New York women think you'll make a fool of any man.
Right.
You play all kinds of games. You will cheat if you can.
True.
Use love like a tool and make a man a fool. What a beautiful motto. But I've got my money, that's it. How can you mind if I split?
When it rained 5 days and the skies turned dark as night, when it rained 5 days and the skies turned dark at night, that was trouble taking place in the lowlands at night.
You know, they say some of our greatest American music was born from the blues. Now, what do you think the blues are? Feeling blue, feeling sad, feeling lonely. That's another word for depression. You know, and some people feel that way all the time. And some of our most beautiful music that we hear seems to come from there, or comes from awareness of that. So, depression has a great effect on us. Our telephone number here is 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. We want to hear from you today. What do you do that exhausts your brain and leaves you depressed? That's an interesting concept. So according to the research that we've been seeing, when a person gets obsessed and they sit and they ruminate and they think and they think and they think, they use their brain's neurotransmitters to exhaustion. And it's almost like you exhaust yourself by thinking. Now, of course, if you're Albert Einstein, you don't necessarily exhaust yourself by thinking because you're dead. No, not for that reason. You don't exhaust yourself by thinking because you're doing creative thinking. And that's replenishing all kinds of stuff, new stuff coming in. But the difference between depressive thinking and non-depressive thinking is the lack of newness. See, when you're depressive thinking, you're going in circles. Obsession, going in circles. Why did he leave me? Why did he cheat on me? Why did he do this? He's a rat. And then you wonder how people who are depressed keep blaming all the time. They're blaming the other guy and blaming themselves. How could I be this way? I'm stupid. I'm wrong. There's something wrong with me. But the obsession itself is burning out the very transmitters we need to live a healthy, happy life. So obsession is part of depression, like a precursor. See? And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about we all have ways of thinking that will burn out our energy. 209-2950, 212-209-2950. Want to hear about you. You know your own patterns by now. What's likely to get you depressed? Now, some of you will say, I get depressed when I go on a bender. If I'm out all night drinking, smoking, hanging out in a bar, I'm not thinking about anything, and then I'm depressed. Well, of course, you're depleted. Depleted the stuff you need. The poor brain. You got to take care of this bunch of organs. It's a gaggle. It's a gaggle of fine folks hanging up there in that little machinery of yours. You got a prefrontal. You got a back frontal. You got ganglia. You got neurotransmitters. You got this family up there. They're talking to each other all the time. One part of the brain that plans things talks to another part of the brain that remembers things. And they recall things back and forth. You see an apple. It says it gets the delicious part of your brain working. And the other part of your brain that says it's a good apple. And another part of your brain that says, should I eat a good apple? Will it ruin my appetite? All kinds of your brain are working. And this little family up there talks to each other all the time. They send transmissions back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And they're doing fine till we mess with them. And when we mess with them is by sticking on a place that's going to lead you to depression. And you know what you could do to get depressed. You know it. So this is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. So you can continue and figure out a way to do this. 212-209. We can do it later.
Come on, let's go.
Oh, yeah, I know, I know. 212-209-2950. Let's take one of your calls. Hi, this is Armand DeMille. You're on the air.
Hi, Armand.
Hi there.
My name is Lakshmi, and I'm in New Jersey. And thank you for your program today. I just had a 45, and I just realized that I have narcissism, what you just talked about, and it's a self-absorption, and it's almost like a dream. And I realized that I had used alcohol and then food and then chronic debt to remain in this almost drunken state. And I really see why the program, like the 12-step programs, want one to, that there has to be some kind of power that takes, that you turn your life over to, you know, to almost remove this this, like you said, this chronic system always just absorbs, and narcissism.
What's your name?
Lakshmi.
Lakshmi. So as you could see, the brain wants to settle down, and so your brain sends you on this search, this egocentric, self-absorbed search for information until it exhausts itself, and then you get tired. Then you get that, and then the depression sits in.
I do. Everything you said was true, but I had one question, and then I will slow down and try to nourish myself more because I'm always working hard. But I just wanted to know, it's a spiritual question. Is there a way that somebody that has this is really just seeking that, trying to run away from that connection to the divine? You know, that we don't want the source to move us?
Well, that's a very important question. Now, is your family from what part of India is your family from?
They're just from northeastern Pennsylvania.
Okay. Go ahead. Yeah. Tell me more about it.
Yeah. So, no, I've always had this, I realized the other day.
I asked, where is your family from?
Oh, they're from Pennsylvania.
Northern Pennsylvania.
Yes.
And in their mind, is there anybody there who's depressed? Anybody in your family?
No.
So when you got depressed, how would they respond to you?
Well, I just spent a lot of time alone. They just ignored, they just ignored me. I always did feel separate from the family, even though it was quite large.
So there comes a question now. Why were you separate from a family that was so large?
I think I did it to protect myself.
Okay, good, good, good. So let's say your brain said, you got to protect yourself because being in this family, as big as it is, is not going to get you what you need. You have to go find your own cave.
Right.
And you're going to have to create your own stuff in your own mind in your own cave.
Right.
And you became a cave dweller as a child.
Yes. Right.
You know, and that's what you perpetuated. That makes sense.
And can I get better from that?
Nah, no chance.
I mean, can I just say, okay, stop now and just, you know, I mean, I have a...
It's a funny thing. It's a funny thing about awareness. Once you begin to see that your brain is running familiar patterns, and they're very familiar patterns, and you giggle at yourself, and you start to laugh at yourself, saying, okay, here's where I am. I'm now in the same spot again and again, without criticizing yourself, but just saying a little Lakshmi, oh, here we are again, back in our room.
Right.
Right? Let's take a walk. That's how you start to do it. You start changing the rules of your brain. The rules of your brain are saying the only safety is alone.
Oh, my goodness. All of a sudden, my kids are here.
That's right, so, because they hear us. They know exactly what we need.
Yeah, they are.
How many kids you got?
Three.
Three of them? Who's the oldest?
16.
And who's under that?
16, 13, and 6.
And which appeared? All three?
Pardon me?
Who appeared just now? All three of them?
Oh, my demanding 16-year-old.
Your demanding 16-year-old. Put her on the phone.
That's the thing I always loved about her, that she always told me exactly what she needed and always got what she needed. Oh, wait.
Could you tell her you're on the phone with the radio and you can talk to her now? I can talk to her.
I'm on the phone with the radio. You want to talk to Armand for a minute? She doesn't want to talk for a minute.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to her. Let me talk to her.
I don't know that she will. Here.
Hi there. This is Armand DeMille.
Oh, she will not talk.
I don't blame her one bit.
She has to go. She needs $3.
Well, that's really important. Give her $3. And
okay.
Look, your whole spirit just picked up.
Pardon me?
Your whole spirit picked up. You got to let the family in.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. But I just didn't know that it was narcissism. It was a great revelation that I had the other day. And it was I did welcome it with acceptance. And I really want to let that go.
You're going to do fine, Lakshmi. Thank you so much for calling in.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
I wanted to get a 16-year-old to tell me what she needed from her mother. See, then I would have told Mom, listen to that. 212-209-2900-2950. It's not that a 16-year-old would know what they want. They just need
$3. 2900.
I'm sorry. 212-209-2900. I was still asking people to give money to the station.
Armin?
Yes, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Joe. How you doing?
Hello, Joe. Good.
Good. Armin, I'm just wondering for yourself, when was the last time you were depressed?
Depressed.
Yeah, okay,
Joe, so not the really funny word. Because to me, to be depressed is to be watching myself in exhaustion. I don't believe a word of my own depression. When I get depressed, and I do get that way, I sit back and I'm watching myself think. So I'm cheated because I don't believe a thing I think. Oh, poor me. I don't believe it. You know, oh, this is rotten. I don't believe it. My attitude is always, the trouble is there's too much I know, you know? And it doesn't give me the luxury of depression. I wish I had it. So it's not that I don't get depressed. But when I get depressed, it's like I look at myself saying, oh, boy, I'm really out of neurotransmitters now. Oh, boy, I don't have, you know, that's what I say to myself. And I let it pass. Give it a little room. What about you, Joe? When do you get depressed?
Well, I'm just saying sort of the life circumstances, if we look at just where things are at today, you this is not the moment for yourself where you
say, I get sad, sure.
You know, just like, wow, I just can't believe all the years that you've been on the radio and just where things are in our culture.
Sure.
The efforts that we made in that regard.
Sadness is different.
Yeah.
Sadness is different than depression because sadness is a sense of loss.
Yeah.
And if I look at the Gulf, I mean, I feel so sad.
Mm-hmm.
If I look at all of Louisiana, I feel sad.
Yeah.
If I look at the people around me, I feel sad. And if I look at my own broken body at times, I feel sad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that's just feeling sad. Depression is obsessing about it and not letting it go.
Yeah, I'm sure we've discussed this before, Armin, but at times, I think Thomas More, Care of the Soul, he speaks of the joy of depression.
Yes, and there's the joy of depression, there's the joy of being in a cave.
Yeah, is it really get to that grounding, one of my favorite authors is Parker J. Palmer, who talks about being, you know, he was saying he was depressed, and now he was looking upon it as a negative, and his counselor said to him, why can't we look at it as just being well-grounded? And when you're close to the ground, there's not a long way to go, not to fall.
Okay, I can understand that. You know, that's putting a positive spin on it by a psychiatrist who obviously knew what depression was.
Yeah, I mean, and just to look at it from that framework.
But, you know, it's true. There are even depressed people out there. There are depressed cultures. Mm-hmm. There are cultures that you could look at where everybody's depressed. Yeah. And even they, in their depression, still have a spirit. Because the depression becomes part of the ground. But when you start blaming yourself, and when you start being miserable, when you start thinking about committing suicide, there you're burning out too much of the stuff. There depression is taking its toll.
Yeah.
There where you can't attend to your own family, your own work, that's when it's not just well-grounded, it's underground.
Well, I know for me, Armin, when I went down to 9/11, I left work, and I went down to 9/11, and yet it was a roller coaster ride for me afterward, just seeing what was going to unfold. There was quite a few ups and downs, just like despondent, disconnect. I just saw myself as just disconnected.
And, you know, Joe, to have seen yourself as disconnected means that you are already observing your depression, which means that you won't go into that same hole. You know, you're a brave man. You're good to hear from you.
Armin, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Joe.
Have a good day.
Thank you. 212-209-2900. Let's take another one of your calls. Hi, you're on the air.
Armin, two things. First, something about last night, and then something about depression for me.
Sure.
Okay. Last night was Bloom's Day. I've heard it before. I did something different last night, and it made all the difference. I downloaded Ulysses from the Project Gutenberg, and I read along with it, and it's incredible to read along as they read it, and they pause certain places, and it's beyond belief. It's so good.
Oh,
also,
great. Thank you.
At 8 o'clock, between 8 o'clock and 8:09, there's another thing that's not part of Ulysses, and it is incredible, something you're going to want to play between, you know, at the half hour. Now, depression.
Hey, send it to me. Did you have a recording of it?
You can get it. It's on the archive.
Okay, I'll get it on the archive.
Yeah.
Good.
Depression. I was horribly depressed. Unbelievably. And they tried me on all these different drugs. And one guy suggested this thing called Nardil, which is an MAO inhibitor. And it means if you take it, you can't eat any cheese
or chocolate,
or chocolate I eat lots of, but you can't have Chianti or red wine because it'll kill you.
Right.
You get a blood pressure. You blow a thing in your brain. And 2 weeks to the day, almost, all of a sudden, the damn thing lifted. I could feel it lifting within a space of 2 or 3 hours. So for people who've tried everything, this thing called Nardil, it's an MAO inhibitor, and you're going to say, I can't go to a party and not drink wine. I can't. My God, every meal at a party is full of cheese, you know. But think about it, because it works for some people, not many. Sure as hell worked for me.
Yeah, and you see, that's one of the things. Now, think about what worked for you. Chemistry worked.
Yeah.
You see, your chemistry was shot in such a way, and the doctors shot you full of things, saying, well, we'll raise the serotonin. Well, we'll do this. We'll do that. And they finally said, we're going to give him the anti-cheesy drug. And that worked for you.
Well,
and you could have felt it.
They suggested it and suggested it, and I refused to do it because I said I can't go without this stuff. I go to a party, you know, and so on. But I did it, and it made all the difference. And I just, you know, it may help some people. Some people will get help for a couple hours by doing this thing, downloading this thing from last night, and from 7 to about 1:45. it and reading along with it, and it's just amazing.
What's your name?
David.
David, thank you very much for calling in.
I've talked to you back and forth about paying for things and not paying, you know, so forth, and keeping records. I'm that guy.
Good, David. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And remember, another cure for depression might be never eating wine or cheese again.
That's okay. Very good.
Without a drug, just give up wine and cheese. Maybe you'll stop being depressed.
Well, I haven't had a drink in 30 years.
Okay. Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
But, you know, as you begin to listen, you begin to see that people are just their own chemistry. You know, people tell me very often they're afraid to take drugs. Well, they'll smoke marijuana, they'll drink alcohol. You know, these are drugs. And then they'll take herbal remedies. These are drugs. Everything that we do, Chinese medicine, is a drug. Not a bad word. It's a chemical. That's it. We're putting chemicals in our body to make our body supposedly feel better. Well, what do you expect? You know, if we're going to try to change it up, we'll change it up. I'm on your team. Let's try to do it as naturally as you can. And in my book, the best thing that we have, the very best thing we have, is number one, awareness, knowledge, and we have each other. This is Armand DeMille with you. With the Positive Mind, I will be back with you on Tuesday at 1 p.m. My special thanks to all of my good friends out there.